We are talking with Andrei Znamensky. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the second hour. And we have much more to talk about. We're going to shift over a little bit of the focus and talk a little bit more about what happened on the, I don't know if it's the opposite side of the world, but almost anyway, in America primarily, at the time when we have, you know, the New Deal coming into effect. We have people like Nicholas Roerich, who of course both was, he's kind of the red thread in this. He's the one who was over in the East as well at the same time, but he's very influential later in the U.S. with the, he was called the guru of Henry Wallace, of course, the agricultural minister. But give us a little bit of an outline of what happened over in the U.S. at this time and how central Roerich is to those developments.
A few chapters of my book, Red Shamble, deal with these two interesting characters, Wallace and Roerich. What I'm trying to do, I'm trying to put these two characters in the context of their time, because those people who wrote about them, for example, it's known that Roerich, Nicholas Roerich in 1934-1935, sponsored by Henry Wallace, he organized a quote-unquote botanical expedition to Manchuria, northeastern China, trying to shop around for drought-resistant plants, but this expedition had this geopolitical and occult twist when Roerich tried to instigate local prophecies and tried to plug himself into local prophecies, and their goal was to jumpstart so-called the Sacred Union of the East. It's a Tibetan Buddhist theocracy in the heart of Asia. Okay, people did write about it. Okay, but what they forget to do normally, they forget to put these two characters in their time, in the time context. Okay, because if you don't do it, the whole thing looks like a bizarre incident. Okay, so what is this? The Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace sponsored this expedition that has this official goal to find drought-resistant plants that could be used in the United States because there was a dust bowl. American farmers suffered a lot at the time, so that was the official goal of this expedition. Okay, and there was also unofficial part, okay, to plug into Tibetan Buddhist prophecies and eventually to jumpstart a spiritual utopia. Okay, so sounds bizarre, you know. But at the same time, when you put this project in the context of the time, you will see it was not so bizarre because the time itself was bizarre, 1930s especially, the time in the wake of the Great Depression, when, again, we talked during the first hour that people were shopping around for a new order, for a good faith, because they were literally devastated by the Great Depression. So it's hard for us to understand. Even the recent crisis, 2008, which was severe enough, we didn't feel it so much. But those folks who lived in during the Great Depression, it was literally devastating for them. That is why we have this revival of socialist, communist ideas. This a bunch of people are shopping around for different utopias. We have a bunch of grand schemes all over the Western world, you know, not necessarily in the United States.
Right.
The States should be included into this picture. But a bunch of grand schemes, you know, and what is special about these schemes, they were ultimate schemes. It's like a quest for schemes that could fix things once and for all. Okay. That was the mindset of that time. And Wallace and Roerich, they were children of that time. So if you look careful at what Roerich offered with his group that became incredibly popular in bohemian circles in New York, and Wallace was adopted as a part of this group under, it was given an esoteric name, Galahad, you know, so he became a spiritual student of Roerich. If we put these things in the context of the time, we will see that this botanical expedition was a natural thing, you know, for Wallace to do. Mm-hmm. That is why I disagree with those biographers of Roerich who simply don't mention this expedition because they kind of feel uncomfortable talking about it. Or those writers who talk about Wallace, they skip this botanical expedition. Or they talk about Wallace being seduced spiritually by the schemer Rohr, who deceived him. You know, there was no deception. Rohr himself, Wallace himself, wanted to be deceived. And in fact, Wallace himself found Rorik. It wasn't Rorik approaching Wallace. Right, right. It was Wallace coming to Rorik Museum in New York City because he was shopping around for spiritual ideas and he was impressed with Rorik. Okay, so Wallace was a theosophist. He joined theosophical movement. And Rorik and his wife, Helena, they established their own branch of theosophy called Agni Yoga, or in other words, Fire Yoga. And Wallace became so fascinated with this because it was not only esoteric, it was beautiful. There was a bunch of Tibetan Buddhism there, so it intrigued him. And he embraced it by 1931, 1932. Rorik became his guru, and together they started talking about this project, which they called sometimes the New Country or the Sacred Union of the East. Or in 1935, they started to use the code word Kansas. You know, they labeled it Kansas just to make sure that nobody will find out about it. And Wallace didn't want to reveal prematurely. In fact, there was a funny correspondence between Wallace and Helena Rorik, a wife of Nicholas Rorik, who actually was a very powerful person who was spearhead of all these ideas. See, we shouldn't forget about her in this case. We should bring her to the picture. So she told Wallace, hold your horses, don't reveal the whole project to President Roosevelt. It's not time yet, you know. So Wallace wanted to tell Roosevelt about it because Roosevelt was fascinated with China, with Buddhism, and he was throwing these things like, I wish I could live in a monastery too, you know. And Wallace asked Helena, can I share with him this image? And she said, the Wayward One, that was the nickname for FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Wayward One is not ready yet for this, so let's wait and prepare him.
That's interesting. So how much power do you think that they actually wield in that regard? How, I mean, okay, this is a little bit later in the story, I don't want to jump ahead, but if they had this plan, if you will, of you know, do implementing certain of these things, does this mean they actually had a, you know, somewhat of a influential position here at this stage?
Yeah, you have to keep in mind that when FDR came to power, there was a bunch of let's call them crackpot philosophers and intellectuals surrounded him, you know. They peddled their own projects, you know. So we have a bunch of different projects. So Wallace was part of this retinue, so to speak, you know. So Wallace was friends with Morgenthau, who became Secretary of Finance for FDR. And Morgenthau suggested that Wallace would be appointed. That's how, by chance, Wallace became part of FDR's circle.
Okay. And he was behind the Morgenthau plan, of course, by the way, which is a huge step after the Second World War. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Rex Stagwell was another person, okay, so who also peddled his own schemes. Yeah. There were different plans. Like, for instance, a wife of FDR, she came up with this idea of Arthur Dale Project. I don't know if you heard about it. In West Virginia, they set up a model village where they tried to put unemployed coal miners and to turn them into organic, wholesome citizens who live close to the land, you know. Or they try to send some unemployed workers to Alaska to pay, I don't know why, to Alaska, to do some agriculture, you know. They, everybody should be close to the soil, you know. Do you see what's going on, you know?
So, sure, exactly. That's a very mimicked ideology that we see in other parts of the world at that time as well, yeah.
Yeah, and it was very powerful, so we have to, you know, pay attention to this. There was a lot of millions of people felt uprooted, especially farmers. You know, you have to keep in mind that Wallace was a person who defended the interests of farmers because he was coming from Iowa, where he belonged to the lineage of the people who were very powerful in the Iowa politics. His father was an editor, and actually he worked for President Hoover, Republican president. So he came from the family that took interest of farmers close to their heart. And when he saw that a lot of farmers were devastated by Great Depression, there was desire to do something good for them, you know. And another thing we have to keep in mind, that almost three-fourths of people who voted for FDR, they were southern and western farmers. Okay, there was a huge voting block of people. So whatever Wallace brought to the cabinet of Roosevelt, it was very significant, very important, and Roosevelt considered him one of the most important people of his cabinet. Okay, so that's what he wanted. To how can I raise, uplift the farmers? You know, and the original idea was that we have to raise the prices for produce. You know, how do you raise the prices for produce?
you remove some of it.
Yeah, you kill the pigs. You know, the price is 6 million pigs. That was another grand project because the prices for bacon are too low. So I want to make sure that farmers make a good income. So
let's just repeat that. That's very interesting. So in September 1933, they killed 6 million pigs.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
6 million pigs were killed originally as a plan to raise the prices for bacon because the poor American farmers suffer. Okay. It's like I call it Stalin upside down, you know. How do you help farmers, you know, because that was the segment of people. Okay. See, it's another grand scheme that was totally bizarre, you know. See, I'm trying to paint the whole picture for you to understand where Rorick and Wallace fit in. Okay.
Yeah.
So there was a special, let's call it, institution was created, Agricultural Adjustment Administration, that was doing these bizarre schemes. Okay. So millions of pigs were killed. So what happened? Yes, the prices for bacon went up, but at the same time, we have people in New York City dying from hunger. So quickly, reporters started asking questions, and eventually they had to backtrack, you know, so they had to change the whole project. They said, okay, guys, you know, it's not a good plan, so let's donate this food to charity. Instead, that's what they started doing, okay? Another grand scheme.
So this is your government at work here, trying to settle something from a central point of view.
Once and for all.
Oh, boy.
So we're coming with this grand scheme, and we're going to fix. Or they had another grand scheme, the same Agricultural Adjustment Administration. So we are going to tell farmers to cut their cotton. You know, they produce too much cotton. The prices for cotton are too low. So let's raise the prices for cotton. So farmers, don't plant too much cotton. So you cut down on your fields. You know? So farmers did not plant so much cotton. So what happened? These African Americans in the South were losing their jobs, the people who were working for the Southern farmers, you know, so it backfired, right. You know, so we have millions of sharecroppers who lost their jobs because of the grand scheme pursued by Wallace, you know.
So crazy.
Farmers were helped, but sharecroppers lost, you know.
How did he, was no one around to say, this is insane, what are you doing? Hey, he had this power to just, you know, decide this on his own?
Single-handedly, you know. The press, of course, fortunately, there was a freedom of press, you know, which
unlike today,
in Europe didn't have at that time. You know? So, and the thing was exposed, and eventually they had to roll back. But we have other grand schemes that were, see, that the mindset of the people at that time was very simple, okay? So what they did, they believed that if science tells us so, okay, or if they thought the science tells them so, we have to do this, okay? And basically, they wanted to impose these schemes on the people without experimenting, just on the entire nation, okay? And that was the not only profound mistake, but it was the best description of the mindset of the people. Okay, we are going to apply this scheme to everybody. Okay, and that's what that is why I'm telling you that we need to get into the mindset. They were children of their time, you know. Essentially, it's the same message of communism in Europe or socialism.
Exactly, it's collective, another flavor of collectivism.
Yeah, we're going to impose the same scheme on everybody. Okay. Yeah. Because science tells us so. It's a worship of science, in other
exactly,
words.
Exactly, exactly.
And the power of the state was used to promote these schemes. You know? Or another story, for instance, that NRA was created, that the National Recovery Administration was created, that told businesses what prices they should set up, what prices that should charge, how much they should produce. You know, that is why we had these incidents when people were thrown into prison who wanted to charge less for their products because they violated the prices that were set to help industry to recover. You know, it's absolutely bizarre. Or another thing, we have a so-called Native American New Deal when John Collier, who was a community organizer, he was a commissioner for Indian Affairs in the FDR administration. He wanted to build up so-called Red Atlantis on Native American reservations, essentially reviving this old tribalism. He believed that the Native Americans were collectivists by their nature. So that is why collectivism should be imposed all over Indian reservations and tribal corporations should be created. Okay, so those Indians who said that we're private farmers, we don't accept you, they were considered non-Indians, not good Indians. Yeah, so that's essentially how a project of tribal corporations was imposed on all Indian reservations. And these governments in reservations we still have to the present day, it's tribal corporations. It's another grand scheme that was imposed on Indians. So let's go back to Wallace and Rorick. So essentially, Wallace had this dream to spiritual revive people. He said, okay, we are going to use science, but at the same time, we need new ideology. Okay, he was not a socialist, of course, he was not a communist. He was a typical progressive who was grounded in this agrarian utopias, indigenous American agrarian utopias. He was coming from Iowa. He experimented with corn, then he set for himself this goal: how can I find this new ideology that would be that would work for American farmers? Because the farmers are backbone of the United States. See, it's another interesting idea which we see in some other countries at that time. And anti-capitalism. Okay.
Yep.
So anti-capitalism, but what kind of society should we embrace? At that time, he didn't know anything about socialism yet. You know, later, in the 1940s, he read about it, he found out, and he became part of this movement. But originally, it was just anti-capitalism and a blind quest for a new order that would help to revive the United States. And that's where Rorick comes in. What kind of new order? Okay. Rorick, by that time, by 1933, he and his wife, Helena, they came up with this project that which they peddled for many years since the early 1920s, that they should blend Tibetan Buddhism and theosophy, okay, and launch this spiritual theocracy in the heart of Asia that would be based on corporatives, see? Corporate societies. That would be the economic foundation, and the ideology would be, they call it Agni Yoga, it's a fire yoga. It's a blend of theosophy and purified Tibetan Buddhism. Okay, that would be the ideology. And that's what attracted the Wallace, okay, who had this mystical part in him. So he becomes a part, integral part of Rorick project. And we have a intensive communication between Wallace and Rorick between 1930 and 1935. Hundreds of letters exchange. In fact, Wallace later eliminated part of this correspondence. So we have literal intimate relationships between two of them. So the idea was, again, we only can speculate here. The idea was to launch the spiritual theocracy, if it happens, you know, by chance, as a kind of a follow-up to this expedition, that would be fine. So, they tried to plug this project into this geopolitical scene of that time, okay? Because the United States was competing with Japan, and they wanted to launch this theocracy as a kind of counterbalance to Japan. So this sacred Union of the East, that's how they called it, would be sponsored by the United States, supported financially by the United States, and Rorick Wallace would set up a bunch of cooperatives, and eventually it would be like geopolitical counterbalance. Okay.
Wow, so these are, of course, very wide-stroking ideas that they're trying to work with there. What's interesting, though, is that it seemed to be very much the same mode in different parts of the world. Who was, I mean, can we just explain it, that it was just as how people were at the time and what they were concerned with, or is there something else that explains that we seem to have so many similar movements around the world at the same time? Who's running this program, I guess?
Well, you know, this particular scheme, of course, was run by Rorick, but again, we see this corporate societies, this corporate structure. In fact, to run this scheme that was to become like a union of this corporate societies in the heart of Asia, Rorick set up a corporation called Corporation UR, U-R, it's, you know, UR. This word describes something original, authentic, you know, primordial, you know, yeah. It's what UR corporation, this corporation would run these corporations. It's the same idea that 1920s, 1930s, that was going around in the minds of the people at the time. So we have Mussolini in Italy setting up corporations, this collectivism. In fact, Rorick always tried to send on different holidays, different occasions, this greetings cards to Mussolini. And you know, once he even asked his secretary, "Don't forget to send greetings to Mussolini." You know, so he's a good person.
this is as well. People have to remember this. That is like at the time, a lot of these political leaders. I mean, what happened afterwards with World War II and everything, and all the debacle there, and all the cover-ups that we've had consequently of actually happened and everything else. It's what we have to keep in mind is that at the time, a lot of these politicians were admired. I mean, Hitler was put on the Times magazine front cover. He managed to, you know, return Germany to a position of economy, which, you know, has been unseen before. This is so when we see someone, for example, shaking hands with Hitler or whatnot, people do the guilt by association immediately without understanding that these were admired and very powerful political leaders at the time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. See, we project. When we talk about this, these events right now, we project our ideas because, you know, the winners write history.
That's right.
And the version of history written after the Second World War is the version of the winners, you know. But if you begin to read the articles, media, this magazines, newspapers of that time, you will see a different picture.
Very much so. Yeah, very much.
So that is why we cannot just say Stalin, Hitler were evil, you know. So Roosevelt was kind of benevolent guy, you know, and that would be it, you know. That's not the whole story. The story was that we have these common features that or common schemes or common mindset that characteristic for people that educated elites at that time, both in the Soviet Union and National Socialist Germany and in the New Deal, the United States.
Yeah, okay? That's right. So that's very interesting. In a way, then, it's also the Western world at that time of kind of the value system overall is kind of not in shambles, perhaps, but it's something that's swinging back and forth. Society has turned into an experiment of sorts, and a lot of things are going on where people are making a lot of weird decisions, right? And it's not really something, again, that actually reflects the interests of the people here. You know, would kill 6 million pigs, for example, and yeah, get away with that, you know. So,
and a lot of farmers wanted it, you know, because see, that's another problem I have with some writers. You know, they tell me you have to have a certain value judgment, moral judgment. I said, well, your history can be approached from two viewpoints. You can approach history from a moral viewpoint, or you can approach history historically, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
And again, what do you want? People wanted this at that time, you know? So you cannot, that's what millions of people want. They wanted these schemes, you know? So, and these grand schemers like Wallace, Rory, and of course, Rory was marginal. He simply plugged himself into this picture. Mussolini, Hitler, Stalin, they reflected the interests of millions of people who brought them to power. It wasn't some kind of evil kind of masterminds who hijacked the innocent people. People brought them to power, okay?
Let me ask you about this. Have you looked into anything of Anthony C. Sutton's work in terms of the funding trail? He's a professor, he's a scholar. I forget which university he was at. He wrote a couple of books about actually the financial trail, primarily immense detailed study in terms of who funded both the Bolshevik Revolution monetarily, but also the rise of Hitler and the Third Reich. Have you heard any about of his work? Because it trails it back to a lot of the powerful Wall Street banks at that time. Have you seen any of this work?
Yeah, I saw his work, you know. But again, my view of the situation as a historian is that there were certain forces at that time which brought to power these people. So no matter what they were thinking, you know, up above, you know, we can argue here that there's a certain time, you know, there's a certain time that demands people to act in a certain way. And the politicians, they try to feel the people, they try to plug themselves, and they take these projects, you know, further and further, try to cater to the interests of the people. That's my view, you know.
Mm, yeah, I see.
No. That's my view. I have to tell you outright that I normally do not subscribe to conspiracy theories. For me, I see the only one conspiracy theory, conspiracy of opportunism and bureaucracy, when people, to save their butts, they want to kind of follow the trendy things, you know, to follow, to join the crowd, you know, and that's where, like a herd of bisons, you know.
Well, absolutely. I'm not denying that there aren't opportunists out there that are jumping on these bandwagons. I guess I'm a bit more cynical, and I see more conspiracy and less theory out there, but that's something for another time, another debate. Tell us how the symbol of the doll, you know, the pyramid over the eye. I mean, we have the artist Rorik, and how that ended up on the dollar bill, and a little bit of that story.
That's a gorgeous story. In fact, I don't write about this in my book, but because I told you, Wallace, late in 1948, he tried to run for president, and his correspondence with Rorik became a liability for him. You know, it was published in the so-called guru letters, and was turned against him. So he destroyed a lot of his correspondence. But those sources which are available tell us that this reverse side of a great seal that was put on the dollar bill, and it happened when? In July 1935, if you remember. FDR signed the document that endorsed this $1 bill, creation of $1 bill, with this reverse side of great seal pyramid, with this eye of all-seeing eye that was put on dollar bill, July 1935. What is July 1945? It's the peak of the so-called cooperation with between Wallace and Rorik. And in the same month, they broke apart, actually. Okay, but the bill itself was printed during this time. Okay, Wallace himself described the story when? Of course, his story is biased. He wanted to completely dissociate himself from Rorik. In 1951, Wallace told people the story. It goes like this, you know. Once I noticed a picture. It was a good picture in a book published in 1909 with this great seal, reverse great seal, the pyramid, and all-seeing eye. And I showed it to FDR, and what attracted me. It's another thing, you know, that tells us a lot about the time they lived in. Wallace said, I became attracted to this phrase that was written at the bottom of this great seal, Novus Ordo Seclorum, which can be translated from Latin as, you know how, right?
New world order.
Order of ages, or new secular order, you know it.
Right, yep.
And I told FDR about it, and he became fascinated with this. And since both of us, we are Masons, that's what he said. I quoted Wallace.
Yeah, okay? That's right.
So we became intrigued by this sign, and FDR decided to put on dollar bill. Although originally Wallace said, I wanted this great seal to be put on a coin, but FDR changed his mind and he put it on a dollar bill. And that's the official story, which already revealing, by the way.
Sure, yeah.
On its own, you know, that's the official story shared with us by Wallace. What is not revealed is that the same old seen eye you can see on many paintings of Rorik during this time, you know, yeah. And the most famous painting that has this all seen eye, which we see on the Great Seal, can be seen on the famous painting by Rorik called the Saint Sergius. Saint Sergius was a Russian Orthodox sponsor and patron of warriors who want to establish the new world, the new order. Okay. And if you look at this painting, you will see a holy man with some army of people down below. Okay, you can, anybody who is interested can Google it, Saint Sergius Rorik, and you will see this painting.
Can you spell that for us?
Saint Sergius.
Saint Sergius, okay.
Sergius, uh-huh. Rorik.
Yeah.
It will immediately pop up. You will see a holy man dressed in a robe. In fact, it was Rorik himself. Okay, the face of Rory. So he pictured himself as the leader of the army. Down below, you can see the huge army of the people, warriors armed with spears.
Yeah.
Okay. So Rory in charge of army of Shambhala that is about to bring up the new order, the new world. And on the top of this painting, you will see the same old seen eye. Okay. And the painting was done in 1932.
Okay. Oh. How about
right
that?
After the Great Depression, it was the peak of their friendship. Okay, they talked a lot about these paintings. Okay, that was the first thing, by the way, that fascinated Wallace when he entered the Rorik Museum in New York in 1929. That's when they met each other. Okay, in fact, the Wallace was introduced to Rorik Museum by a very shady character. His name is Dmitry Borodin, who worked for Bolsheviks in 1918. He was an agriculturalist who worked not far from New York at the agricultural station. He did some shady jobs for Bolsheviks. So he traveled to Iowa, and they had a talk with Wallace in 1929. Wallace was upset, Great Depression. I have a spiritual crisis, Wallace told Borodin, this the messenger of Bolsheviks, and can you point me to some spiritual teacher who can show me the light? And this Borodin said, hey, I know the guy, it's Rory, who lives in New York City. So, and Wallace comes to New York City in 1929, goes to this place in Manhattan, the Rory Museum, crosses, enters the door, you know, at first people who worked for the museum, they were surprised with the strange man, and he said, I'm Henry Wallace, and eventually that's how they became friends. And the first thing that fascinated Wallace about Rorik was his paintings, okay, very powerful paintings.
Right.
If you see Rorik paintings, you will see these enigmatic, spiritually charged images from the Orient, you know, there's a bunch of spiritual images, you know, loaded images, okay?
Yeah.
So a person like Wallace was absolutely fascinated with this. So, again, it would be an educated guess to say that talking with Rorik about this all-seeing eye and the great seal, they might have decided to do this, to have this conversation with FDR, okay? But unfortunately, we don't have documents to support this, you know? But again, the intimate relationships between two of them, this fascination of Wallace with the Rorik painting, this all-seeing eye, you know, at least sends to me personally a message that it could be the reason why Wallace suggested to FDR this, to... put this great seal on the dollar bill.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
July 1935, the peak of the friendship, you know. At the same time, the same month, they broke relationships. But at the same time, you know, the plans to print $1 bill were made many months before, of course.
So how should we interpret this then? I mean, obviously, it's a symbolic act, right? But is there something more behind it? Is any of the philosophies of Rorik himself kind of incorporated into what was managed to push through and everything with the New Deal? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is what kind of new world was it that they were seeking to build? And in terms of America, at least, did that become fulfilled in some way?
The new world, actually the whole blueprint of this new world, the new Novus Ordo Seclorum, new order of ages or New Deal, was described by Helen Rorik in her book in 1933. It was called Guidelines for the Leader. Okay, she publishes this book. It's a small circulation. I wish it could be translated into English, but it was actually English translation was prepared and shared with Wallace and with American students of Rorik, and it gives you more than 100 guidelines how true leader should act, you know. And it's a fascinating book. It actually described to us that what was going on in the minds of the people at that time. And right. Essentially, she says in this book that a true leader should be powerful, totalitarian leader who should just railroad his scheme no matter what, because this desperate time needs a powerful leader, you know. And if people trust power in this powerful leader, you know, so he should go railroad his schemes no matter what, you know. And of course, cooperatives, collectivism, education, that militarization of society, you know, it's an interesting thing.
It's all there, huh? Anyway, then.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
What? And Wallace, of course, read this, a new religion, that a new religion should be based on this, the cooperative idea of collectivism, okay, theosophy.
Yeah.
It's a great brotherhood, a Tibetan great brotherhood. It's a bunch of theosophical guidelines mixed with these, I call them ideological blueprints that captivated minds of the people at that time all over the Western world.
Right, exactly. Well, would you say that because of these values and because of the implementation of them, as it seems like then, that have we turned our back on the true values of the West? Are we living in some kind of hodgepodge right now? Or how do we retain some kind of our own identity, I guess?
Well, we're still... again, now we are shifting away from the Rorik topic, but it's okay, you know. Let's talk a little bit about this. And I think it's a good. We need to make a good point. I think we still live in the shadow of these schemes that drove people's behavior in the 20th century. Okay.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the cult ideology dies slowly, you know, and this the big state. This fascination with science, with great leaders, saviors. We always need a savior, you know. And and that's when talking about individual freedom. It's a recent phenomenon, by the way. And it only started, believe it or not, in 1960s, 1970s. You know, on both sides, modestly. And it now only became pop. 1980s, 1990s. Before, it was this faith in great saviors, you know, the great saviors should come and save us, you know. And that's right. What millions of people believed, you know, especially in so-called underdeveloped countries. You know, fortunately, in the Western countries, we had some kind of segments of population who could challenge this, but not necessarily, especially if you talk about the Great Depression. We have the same kind of mentality, this faith in great leaders, enlightened masters, you know. Right. And that's... Right. Historical setting that Rorik plugged himself in, you know, and the Wallace was part of this, you know. Wallace, in fact, thought about himself as one of these enlightened masters. Okay, I know the science, you know, I know what to do, you know, so I'm going to reshape the whole world. You know, it's so funny, you know, when you look at this, what these people did at that time, you know. But for those years, you know, it was a perfect fit, you know, I guess.
Well, tell us a little bit more about some of Rorik's, I guess, inspirations. He had some kind of virtual, I guess, teacher. I don't know if he channeled and stuff, but he had some, was it Master Moria or something like that?
Yeah. His wife, in fact, before I talk about Rorik's spiritual teachers, we have to talk about theosophy. Okay, I hope your listeners know what it is, you know.
Sure, we've talked about it in the past, sure, yeah.
Briefly, I will give a gist, my take on theosophy. You know, theosophy emerged when? 1876, created by Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Henry Olcott. Why? Why it became so popular among the educated people in the West? Because the same reason, because it was science and religion at the same time, okay? Because what Madame Blavatsky wanted to do, she wanted to embrace all these fancy scientific concepts, including Charles Darwin evolution, and to merge it with religion, okay? So educated people did not believe in religion anymore, but at the same time, they needed God, they needed spiritual life. So theosophy gave them this thing, okay? So some of these people actually became Marxists later.
Well, exactly. I was going to say, we made a joke about that in the past, that, you know, the image of Karl Marx, how much it looks like the classic depictions of Yahweh, you know, with his big beard, the man in the sky, right? Or they could go for Blavatsky, I guess, the other half of them then.
Yeah. In fact, by the way, this the whole concept of Madame Blavatsky, that this great brotherhood, they reside somewhere in abode in Tibet and controls the world. It's the whole idea of this group of revolutionaries that know the true path, you know, that they will show the light. It's very similar, okay? So no wonder when among the early Bolsheviks, we have some people who actually toyed with theosophy and Marxism at the same time, okay? Which irritate Lenin, who said, oh, we know the science is Marxism. You know, don't play with Madame Blavatsky ideas. You know? Little did he know that the whole thing came from the same source, you know, because it was scientific religion, quote unquote. That's how I understand these things. That's how I explain these things for myself. Now, going back to the spiritual masters that were channeled by Rorik and Helene, these were spiritual masters that were channeled by Madame Blavatsky originally. So basically, Rorik and his wife, they hijacked Madame Blavatsky, spiritual masters, you know. At first, they claimed they were interacting with two masters, messengers of the great Himalayan brotherhood. But later, they claimed that it was only one master who came to them and told them what to do. It was Moria, Master Moria. And that's what they were doing, this whatever project they tried to fulfill, Rorik and his wife, they claimed that it was the message of Master Moria. So they had these spiritual sessions when they talked with Moria and transcribed his messages. Helena Rorik originally was the one who created the whole thing. You know, she said, I'm channeling this spiritual masters, which had been channeled originally by Blavatsky. Then Rorik joined her, okay? And then the whole circle, the people who were around them, they also participated in these sessions when they kind of asked questions of Mori and what to do. And again, they sincerely came to conclusion that they received these messages and acted upon this, you know? So the people were true believers, you know? In fact, Helena Rorik, she had trauma of her head when she was young, you know. She had these divine headaches, you know, and during these divine headaches, she had these revelations that Master Moria came and told her, okay, what to do. She had the diaries, thousands of pages, which you can find online, you know, if you Google Helena Rorik diaries, you know, it will pop up, so you can read them, okay?
Wow.
Some of them translated into English, you know. In fact, whatever projects they pursued, this the Sacred Union of the East, you know, these cooperatives in Inner Asia, going to Tibet at first in 1920s, then going to Manchuria, they believed that it was the order of this master, otherworld master Moria, you know, who told them so.
Well, that's dodgy. Who's that character? If you know, it's always interesting when people come religiously inclined towards someone and just blindly follow them. I don't know if they blindly followed this entity, whatever it is, but Yeah, that's always dodgy stuff. So, what do you think in terms of the spiritual aspect to that? Is that a delusion? Is there something to it? Are these people making it up?
For me, person who doesn't buy these things, of course, it's a delusion. But yep. For those people who believe into this, you know, it becomes their second reality. You know, so I have to accept it. It's like any form of religion, you know. So I accept it because for other people, it's reality. You know, in fact, it's a very powerful thing.
But do you think it's something internal? It's the subconscious coming through these people? Is that how you would explain it in a rational way?
Part of subconscious, and especially there's another thing here, you know. It's like it's self-fulfilling business, you know. When you do these things and people around you become interested in this, you become empowered into this. It's a natural thing. And in our case, it was this. Especially empowering for Helena and Nicholas Roerich. Why? Because they have Wallace, who comes, this politician, and who literally falls in love with this. So they were so inspired. Okay, and then they have FDR, who becomes interested in all these. Do you know that FDR, there was a second line of communication in addition to Wallace, that Helena Roerich corresponded with FDR. They exchanged letters, and FDR became interested in her divine messages. So if you go to FDR Museum, you will see a bunch of letters written by Helena Roerich to FDR, where she gives him advice on financial policies, how to handle a financial crisis, you know, how what to do, the gold standard or silver standard, you know, how to do geopolitical decisions. And FDR became interested in this. We don't know to what extent he listened to the stories, but he saved all her messages. And a person who communicated, who was a middleman between Helena and the president, listen to what FDR had to say, put it in writing, and then delivered this to Helena. Okay? And Helena responded to FDR. So FDR was interested in these messages, you know. So I guess the great politicians, they sometimes gambled on the advice of these mediums. And that's what empowered them, you know. See,
right.
When they felt that these great ones, great politicians suddenly became interested in this. It was so thrilling for them. In fact, there is a funny thing which I don't write about in my book. The middleman who was delivering messages from Helena to FDR president and from FDR to back to Helena, Nicholas Roerich himself was in Manchuria at that time, an expedition. This middleman, who was a financial sponsor of all Roerich projects. His name is Louis Horsch, you know. He became so fascinated with his role as a middleman. He was so thrilled that he was so close to power that eventually he came to conclusion that he was the messenger, you know. So in his sideline, Helena Roerich and Nicholas Roerich. And he himself started claiming that he and one of the members of Roerich circle named Esther Lichtman, they were the messengers of the Great Brotherhood. So, and they started communicating with FDR and Wallace, you know. That's what actually brought this disarray, this Roerich circle in disarray, you know. Not so much this American media that started to write about Manchurian expedition, that the schemes Roerich was doing in Manchuria, but also this internal split in Roerich circle when Horsch, this currency speculator who originally sponsored Roerich projects, became so thrilled that he was close to the president that eventually he came to believe that he was the messenger of this.
Well, that's convenient, right? It's a self-reinforcing...
Yeah, they sidelined Helena.
Yeah, exactly. This is self-reinforcing, you know, their own importance in that degree. That's very interesting. Now, let's see if there's anything else here we should touch upon before we start wrapping up here in a little bit for this time. There's a lot of components, of course, more of what you talk about in the book, but is there any other bigger events like this? I guess I would like to ask you a little bit about the influence of not only esoteric teachings, but I guess overall, you know, you mentioned the Freemasonic connection before. If there's anything else there that we should know about, if there's any other influences, I guess, in the Rurik's lives?
Well, you know, there's a claim that he was a Freemason. You know, in my research, I, to be honest, didn't find any evidence that he was a Freemason. So what I clearly see here is that Rurik was obsessed with this theosophical idea that he was a true believer who came to conclusion that I am the messenger of the great Himalayan Brotherhood that sent me and my wife to bring this new order, this Novus Ordo Seclorum, you know, to shape the world, you know. And Wallace and FDR, who were Masons, as you know, right?
Yep.
Here we can have evidence that Wallace himself said this, you know. As a historian, I go by the evidence. And Wallace became attracted to this message. And the link between Rurik and Wallace was Theosophy and Tibetan Buddhism, okay? That was the major link. Plus, yep. Rurik was definitely a charismatic person, okay? So that's another reason that attracted Wallace in to Rurik ideas.
Well, indeed, exactly. And I guess he wouldn't come that far if he didn't have something to go for him in that regard, right? So that's just how it goes. But yeah, very interesting history, of course, very, very different and very, it paints a picture, different, you know, picture of everything that's been going on. But I really enjoy talking about the way that this some of the spiritualist ideas would brought into, you know, the left as well in that regard. And let's talk just a little bit about the New Age overall, and I guess the, you know, the progressive movements of the Western world today and everything, and how much you see that that is a still kind of echoing the same components you know, what to do to kind of break free of that, I guess. Are there similarities of everything that's going on today? So is it kind of an extension to all the things that we've been talking about, really, in a way?
Yes. You, again, made a good point. As I mentioned, I think first hour that I see Wallace and Rurik as forerunners of the ideas that later in 1960s, 1970s captivated the minds of millions, these pilgrimages to the holy sacred Orient, to Tibet, Nepal, India, or fascination with the tribal spirituality, with Tibetan Buddhism, you know. In their time, it was still a marginal phenomenon, but in our time, it became the mass phenomenon. And right now, we have a revival of Rurik ideas, at least in Russia, for instance. In Russia, he is held in the high esteem. There are hundreds of thousands of people who follow him, who created different groups. They follow his ideas. His books are published all over Russia. And in some extent, in the West, we have groups of people who are fascinated with Rurik ideas. But we should look at this phenomenon more broadly. You know, it's like you said, we should talk about the New Age in general. Okay, what fascinates me in the New Age project is that right now the whole idea of New Age became like the last exit for the left. Okay, so that pursuit of New Age ideas, some blended with the Hinduism or pop therapy, with neo shamanism, environmentalism is a very important part of this. Okay, so that became this kind of counterculture that captivated a lot of people on the left, and right now creates this ideological baggage that feeds these ideas, you know. At that time, they didn't need it, but right now, it's a very popular bunch of ideas that creates this bubble, okay, that shapes the minds people on the left, okay. That right now, for instance, if I will give you just a comparison that might be interesting for your listeners, like if you go to news media in the United States in 1930s in the wake of the Great Depression, the debates were, do we need communism or we still need capitalism? You know, is communism as the way of the future, socialism, how to set up cooperatives. That was the debate. Do we really go to socialism? At that time, what do we have right now? Right now, it's a debate like this, The whole world is going to hell, We need environmentally conscious people, Do we have environmental Armageddon? Or we have this powerful government that
it's gonna save us
comes
all.
Up with projects that would show us the light,
Right, so, right.
So do we go and eat well, Do we recycle, as a way of salvation, It's, or we don't recycle. That's the debate which is going on right now,
Yeah.
Are we sensitive to non-Western cultures that can show us the true wisdom or not? That's the debate, And if you are not sensitive, you're reactionary, So it's that's the debate that is going on right now. See that the lines of debate are totally different. So I'm trying to describe to you this the bubble that shapes minds of the people in our time, this sort of ideology.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. And I mean, we talked about that a little bit in our email correspondence back and forth as well. The issues with the political correctness and how we're plagued by that in the West, and also, of course,
in
the academic world.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure, yeah.
What I think what is common between 20th century and the 21st century, between these, let's say, 1930s socialism and present day kind of environmentalist movement, is that this group thought, that a desire to impose these grand schemes on entire society, on entire country, that's what more and more people, by the way, both on the left and on the right, they have problems with this, and I think that's what we see in both Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement, We have this trend, at least I see, that people want to go beyond left and right. They want to turn more to self-government, autonomy, individual freedom, They don't want to be trapped into this, in the web of these grand schemes,
Right, right. Well, a lot of people are still stuck in it, So that's the issue, I feel. That a lot of people are ideologically trapped in, 19th or 20th century consciousness in a way, and they don't see individualism,
absolutely.
And
in fact, I admire some people on the left who try to kind of to break through their ideological bubble, but it's very hard to do. I will give you an example. Imagine Martin Luther revolting against the Roman Pope, what could he do? He used the same discourse, this religious discourse, this Catholic Church discourse, to fight against the Roman Pope. The same thing we have today. We have certain bright ideas on the left, but they try to use this Marxist or semi-Marxist discourse, trying to promote these ideas. It's funny to observe it. For instance, there's certain ideas that had been articulated by Friedrich Hayek a long time ago about individual freedom and all these things in 1920s, 1930s. But, of course, the left didn't know about it, that it was not only taboo, but simply so marginal, But now they came to the same ideas, and they try to use, humanistic Marxism. They try to shape Marx as Marxism, humanism, to turn Marxism closer to human beings, environmental conscience, individualism. See, it comes from this ideology, but it's a slow process. We still have this kind of a Roman Pope, this a church-like structure that still controls the discourse,
Absolutely.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, definitely, of course. And this very idea, too, that it's like the solutions is still very much within looking towards, a big government or administrative bodies to solve all these issues. And they're very much the same as well. I mean, the right and the left, the political spectrum has not only narrowed. I mean, it has moved slowly towards the left progressively, and in some cases actually very quick. So, but it's still very much the same expression, right? And people are still stuck in that consciousness,
It's very hard to kind of move ahead for obvious reasons, you know, because the old ideas die hard. You know, for instance, right now there's still a lot of fascination with the New Deal, you know, in the United States. When you, for instance, come to like an old veteran who, I don't know, was part of CCC, the Civilian Concentration Corps, he like 90 plus something year old. He holds the picture of FDR and he's like, that was my savior, you know, that was my master, you know. When I see this stuff, you know, I want to tell these people, you know, now you understand why Russians like Stalin, you know. So it's of course, it's in the United States, whatever was going on in Europe, it was in a more benign way, you know, it wasn't so harsh, you know. But still, it's the same process. And,
of course,
and I see this still some fascination with these ideas of the 20th century, which, and these ideas die hard, you know, these ideas of collectivism, these grand schemes, you know, it's so hard to move to individual freedom. Like, for example, look, one example, people on the left, they are not fascinated anymore with these, let's say, grand schemes which Henry Wallace peddled, and or people like Henry Wallace, you know, and on the level of ideas, you know, like postmodernism destroyed them, you know, it's like knowledge is individual, knowledge is so individual that we cannot even plan anything, any schemes, you know. But at the same time, when the same people talk about what the state should do in practical economic policies, social policies, they still worship the welfare state, you know, that they still want this grand schemes, they want the big state to come so and help people, quote unquote. So we have this contradiction in their minds, you know. Some people don't even understand this contradiction. So on the level of intellectual ideas, we see this movement away from grand schemes, and the postmodernism actually did the job. It's kind of was a death warrant to Marxism, you know. So they, within their left discourse, they came to a conclusion that this Marxist bubble, you know, didn't make any sense. That they embraced postmodernism, but on the level of practical policies, they still worship the grand state, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly. And it's reforming all the time. Of course, it attracts new words and new definitions, but the core issues are very much the same, I'm afraid, which is the dangerous aspect here. But I think we should begin to wrap things up there for this time. Very wise words, of course, from someone who's you know, lived through the Soviet Union and studied history and religion and all kinds of interesting aspects. So good talk, Andrei. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure having you here. Why don't you leave us again with giving your title of the book, of course. Tell us where people can pick up copies of it, and give us your YouTube channel as well.
Thank you for having me. Again, the title of the book is Red Shambhala, Quest Books 2011, and the address of my YouTube channel is Magus West.
Very good. Thank you, Andrei.
Thanks a lot.
There you go. Interesting program, a completely different view, not only on the religion that so many in the West got the hots for, but also the religious component to the left, the progressives, and the collectivists. Take it from a man who lived through the horrors of the Soviet Union to know about the religious and philosophical backdrop to this murderous ideology, and also how it found common ground in spiritualism and ideas of utopia. I think it's wise to ask yourself where in all of this the New Age fits in. Do we see echoes of this somewhere else today? Talk of socialist utopia with that sprinkle of spiritualism weaved in? Today, of course, the buzzword is consciousness. But how can you have any of that without knowing any of the history? Thank you so much for listening and for being a member. We do appreciate your interest and your dedication to learn and to understand the hidden components in our world and what makes it tick. Some of our upcoming guests include Mark McCandlish, Frank Myers, Dan Parks, Petter Amundsen, Ashari S, aka DM Murdoch. We'll be back in just a few days. Please take good care of yourself, your family, and we'll continue to question the actions of our self-appointed traitorous leaders. Have a good one. We'll talk to you later.